For the conversation, we're going to do a very liminal thing. We're going to have a silent conversation afterwards, and we're going to contemplate this idea. If you shoot a mime, should you use a silencer? Wow. Dying is easy, comedy is hard. On the Ash Wednesday thing, I just got to say, I think I've said this before. I'm baffled that Ash Wednesday is like next week, or not even. I mean, it's like here. Why don't we just do that now? I just want to warn you, especially those of you that maybe have a more of a forehead than maybe others. I was a Baptist boy, went to a Catholic school, and participated in Ash Wednesday. Didn't do a lot of that in the Baptist church, but the Catholic Church, it's a thing. And it was always very judiciously applied. But here at Liminal, man, when I have left the various Ash Wednesday services, on this head, it is a canvas. So, oh my gosh. So, you've been warned. Good morning. I'm Brian. I'm one of the many members of our teaching team. I welcome you today to Liminal. Today, we will be concluding. I don't know what they're trying to tell me, but I've concluded the last two sermon series. It's like, well, we got to put him in last. So there you go. Today, we're concluding our series, Saints and Mystics. If this is your first time with us, and you've missed all the other series installations, it's on our website, liminalventura.org. I'd like to apologize up front. There's some words in this that I am going to make a mess of, especially words that are in other languages, because I can mess up a word. So right away, just take that as an apology, not only for languages that are gone or not very used or I'm not familiar with, but the English language as well. So take that with a grain of salt. If you want to come to the conversation, I will try to translate whatever I said that you couldn't get. So here we go. Today's teaching is entitled, there you go, Deus Meus et Omnia. Anybody recognize that? Oh, wow, okay, good, I'm glad. It's translated this, my God and my all. We'll get to back to that in a few. There's something regal about the sound of Latin. Doctors use it, the clergy use it. And the guy I'm going to show you a picture of next, he's very familiar with it because he's no longer with us, and we'll get to that in a second as well. But this church specifically, there's been a call to go back to the Latin Mass. Big call. This is George Mario Bergoglio, also probably butchered his name. I'm sorry, Jorge. He was made the 266th Pope on March 13th, 2013. Not that long ago, really, in the scheme of things. But wow, has there been a lot of things happen in the ensuing couple of decades. A position he held until his death in April of 2025. As the Pope, he was the leader of the Catholic Church, right? The Catholic Church, at last count, was about 1.4 billion people. Think about that. 1.4 billion members of the Catholic Church. That is one big church. To attempt to lead that many people, it's hard to wrap your head around it. No wonder they have their own country in the middle of Italy, right? The Vatican is actually its own country surrounded by a wall in the middle of another country. The Cardinal George Bergoglio was soon to be made Pope, recalled the moment in the conclave. Has anybody seen the movie The Conclave? Obviously not factual. It is a movie, but it's super interesting. The conclave itself is just, man, I feel really hemmed in here. I think this was intentional. All right, I'll stay here. Keep Brian in his place. It's fascinating, the whole procedure. In my lifetime, it's happened several times. Even as a kid, I remember watching it going, what is with the white smoke and the black smoke? And they literally take the cardinals, right, the princes of the Catholic Church, and wall them away and don't allow them. They can go to sleep, but they move into their dormitories and then they go back into the conclave. And they don't, because back in history, conclaves could take years. And at some point in the church history, they said, no, that's it. You guys are coming. We're going to wall you in here. And you're not basically coming out until you pick a new leader of the church. So it's a fascinating process. And so this is a quote from Jorge when he was sitting in the conclave, and he said this, as things got dangerous, think about it, 1.4 billion, with a B, people, the population of the United States is 348 million, give or take. 1.4 billion, if I'm not a math guy, that's four times more. So when you're the pontiff, you are leading a group of people that are four times the size of the United States. And when you think of what's going on in our country right now and the divide and the problems with 348 million, what does that look like with 1.4 billion? So dangerous, the fact that he said this as he was sitting here, sitting in the conclave, realizing that he was getting more and more votes as each time the rounds of votes were coming. That got him to the number 77, beyond the number 77, which chose him as the pontiff. I you know, as a person who loves theater, to try to have an empathy or an understanding of what that's like, I don't know how you can, unless you're sitting in that seat. So as the cardinal, after saying, wow, you know, when things got dangerous, he continued the story. He said he was sitting next to his great friend, which was the Brazilian cardinal Claudio Humes. Who quote unquote comforted me. I don't know how you comforted him. When the votes went over 77, that he needed to be pope, the cardinal turned to Jorge and hugged him. He said, he kissed me and said, don't forget the poor. So since 1555, the elected popes of the Catholic Church have selected a new name, right? A name that sets the tone for their papacy. There were some in the 6th century that did it, but it was really in 1555 where every pope since then has picked a name to kind of set their mark. Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio selected a name that has never been used in the history of the Catholic Church by a pope, and that was Francis. This was supposed to be really dramatic. Right? Or maybe I had that wrong. No, Francis. Oh, that's it. Sorry, you're right, Becky. Becky, I'm not following my own notes. I apologize. As in St. Francis of Assisi. That just seemed really proper. Who's our subject for our time together today? A person who lived a life of Deus Messis et Omnia, my God and my all. It's also translated my God and all things. The Latin can be either one. Both have very similar meaning, but profound difference. St. Francis was the founder of the Franciscan order, whose motto, Pax et Bonum, means peace and goodness. This, Deus Mess and Omnia, my God and my all things, was also an important phrase to Francis. So they're both kind of mottos of the Franciscan order. The new pope, in March of 2013, said that he took to heart the words of his friend not to forget the poor and chose to be called after St. Francis of Assisi, the man of poverty, the man of peace, the man who loves, the man who protects creation. He said this, how would I like a church that is poor and that is for the poor? Christ is the pastor of the church, but his presence passes through the freedom of human beings. Is the people of God, the holy people of God, because it is journeying towards an encounter with Jesus Christ? Among them, one is chosen to serve as a victor on earth, but Christ is the center, the focal point. And with that, the new pope put his words into action, compelling the church at large to be more compassionate, more inclusive, humble force in the world. You can look at his papacy, and that is what drove him. Was he entirely successful? No. 1.4 million people. But he worked on it. one of his first of many examples, you know, besides the fact that he wouldn't, his dress was simple for a pope. You didn't see him a lot in the pointy hat and a lot of the gold. It was mostly, you know, this picture of him here. Simple. He ate his meals with the rest of the people in the Vatican, by and large. He right away, you could tell, this guy was different by the choice of his name and how he led his life. So one of the first examples he did within weeks, he visited a juvenile prison, and he washed the feet of a Serbian Muslim girl on a Holy Thursday, just before Easter, an action that sent a message. I mean, when that happened, I went, "Oh my gosh, that's Babe Ruth, like pointing at the stands." He knelt, this man that led 1.4 million billion people, and washed the feet of this young girl in this juvenile prison. It's an action so reminiscent of St. Francis. When a contemporary leader of the world's largest Christian church changes his name to a saint who lived over 800 years ago, it's worth a little bit of our time and consideration. This will be a quick trip, by the way. Of course, Francis wrote this in his orders, his first orders to his newly created group of teachers, preachers, was simple. It was just a few words. There actually are no actual, these papers were, none of the papers that the first friars carried with them has ever been found. He did put other things in writing. And rule 9 of one of his list of rules was this. It's entitled, Of Preachers. This is what Francis wrote. I also warn and exhort that the same brothers that in preaching they do their words be fire tried and pure and for the utility and edification of people, announcing them vices and virtues, punishment and glory, and these are the lines I want to get to, with brevity of speech because the Lord made his word short upon the earth. Paraphrase, Francis says, don't spend a lot of time. Get to the point. I'd like to highlight a couple of books that I've used to help me understanding of St. Francis and my preparation today. This is one of them. If you'd like to dig deeper, I can't recommend either of these books enough. This one is my favorite, Francis, A Revolutionary Life. I've had it for a while, which is interesting for those of you that remember it. I've had it so long that this was the bookmark I had. It was from the V-Hop. Before the vineyard, when it was the hop, and the vineyard came over 20 years ago, this was my bookmark in here. So I've had this book a lot. It's written by a guy named Adrian House. He's an Oxford trained, schooled writer. And the cool thing about this book is that it's a book on history, to be sure. It's filled with all kinds of footnotes, but it's a book on history that doesn't read like a history book. It tells the story, he lived in Assisi for several years. I mean, it's deeply researched. It's a great book. You can look at it if you come to the conversation. Also, there's another book that helped me in my prep today, St. Francis of Assisi, His Life, Teachings, and Practice. This is by John M. Sweeney. It's got a foreword by a guy many here at Liminal really like. He's a favorite. That's Richard Rohr, OFM. Anybody know what OFM stands for? Really? Oh, that's interesting. Order of the Friars Minor. Francis said that his friars should be called the Friars Minor because they were less. They were of not significant. They were not significant. The Orders of the Friars Minor, which Richard Rohr is a friar of the OFM, and so he writes that after his name. He's also known as a Franciscan. Francis called them Friars Minor because they had no significance. But today, there are approximately 650,000 Franciscans in 110 countries. So individually, maybe not of significance, but their movement certainly is. Giovanni di Pietro Bernardone, you got to say it like that, it's an Italian name, Bernardone, thank you for laughing, Jared, was born around 1181, around 81. His father called him Francis. There's no absolute accurate date known for his birth. We do know the date of his death, which I think is significant. It's October 3rd, 1226. To me, it's telling, right? His birth was of not any great consequence. He was just another baby boy born in Assisi, right? But his death was noteworthy. It had meaning because he was noteworthy, because he had changed the world by the way he lived most of his life. That's why we're talking about him today. Francis grew up in a home of privilege, which came with an education. His father was a wealthy textile merchant at a time of economic difficulty that was throughout the land. You know, Rome had collapsed. Things were kind of a mess. Francis, being a kid educated in a wealthy home, he wanted to be a knight. Right? You think about it, the Arthurian legends were in full force. He had this dream of, you know, mounting on a horse with armor and going out and, you know, winning honor on the battlefield. He wanted to be a knight. So, at the age of 21, he got his chance. Going to war with a neighbor of Assisi, the city of Perugia. So Perugia is actually a big city. It's about, back in its day, it's about 20,000. Assisi was 5,000. So it's kind of like the mouse that roared coming against a bigger. And they were not far from each other, and they were fighting over land and what have you. So he gets his chance. On the field of battle, he gets knocked off his horse and lands in the mud. And they probably would have killed him right then and there, except his armor was expensive. And so the combatants that he was versing realized that, you know, this kid's family probably can pay a ransom. So instead of ending his life right then and there in the field of battle, they took him to prison, stripping him of his armor and selling that off and waiting for somebody to buy him back. He spends nearly a year in prison. Upon his release, he's very ill. Possibly suffering from tuberculosis. He goes home to recuperate and prepares for battle yet again. After another year goes by, he again goes to war. Falling ill on the first night he is out and struggling with dreams, he returns home after one day. Think about that. His whole adolescence has been spent dreaming about being a knight. First time, he gets knocked down, armored, stripped, put in prison, comes home ill, recuperates. This is a little bit of a dark night of the soul for this young man. He goes out one day and suffers from nightmares and sickness. Now, they didn't obviously use this term back then, but today we would look at that and say, that sounds a lot like PTSD, that he is struggling with the things he was confronted. He was also struggling with a very profound question. Who am I? What am I? What is my worth? The very essence of my being. His two attempts at being a noble knight led him to question his career path. Several events led to him to his ultimate calling. First would be the lepers. Francis says that, quote, God led me among them. He was once terrified of them. No surprise, right? Leprosy, as it's talked about in the Bible, Dives and Lazarus. And so in Italy, they called the houses that the leopards lived in Lazarus houses, houses where they would store people. Because once you contracted leprosy or were diagnosed with leprosy, you changed your clothes to this like gray tunic that warned people that you were carrying this disease. You mostly walked alone if you were not in your stuck in your little house. You were decaying. You were literally rotting throughout your body. You smelled, and you were terrifying to all those that were not other lepers, pretty much. And so Francis, there was tales about him giving them money, but it was always at a distance, like leaving it on a rock and running away, that kind of thing. So he finally decides to conquer this fear. And he over and over, he spends times with the lepers. He grabs their hands with his hands. He kisses their hands. He completely conquered that fear. The care of these humans, truly the least of these, afflicted with this ostracizing, devastating disease, becomes a continual effort of Francis. Interesting side note, medically. I'd love to talk to James about this afterwards. But I read that if Francis indeed suffered from tuberculosis as a result of his time in prison, it may account for why, even though he was continually exposed to lepers, he never contracted leprosy. Because the bacteria of the two diseases are not dissimilar. They're similar in nature. And TB, being the stronger of the two bacterias, may have created some sort of defense against the leprosy. Interesting. Again, don't know if it's true, but interesting. Francis and a friend later traveled to Rome. Rome was about 100 miles from Assisi, so not an extended walk. He and his companion were overwhelmed by what they saw. If you have the opportunity ever to go to Rome, it's an overwhelming place. People have been building on top of people, on top of people, on top of people for generations. It's something. It's kind of like going to New York City. And they were overwhelmed by what they saw. But Francis did something really interesting on this visit to Rome. He swapped clothing with a beggar because he always wanted to experience what it was like to beg, to ask help of others, to look for coin. And he does that. It provided him with significant insight. So here's a copy of Francis's first recorded prayer. He hears the voice of God while kneeling in prayer at a dilapidated church of San Demonio in Assisi. Staring at the cross, Francis prays, "Most high, glorious God, enlighten the darkness of my heart, it give me true faith, certain hope and perfect charity, sense and knowledge, Lord, that I may carry out your holy and true command. Amen." Clear, Francis, at the end of praying, clearly hears God say to him, "Go and rebuild my church." And so he does. Or at least he tries. He sells his horse. He goes to his father's business, storage, and takes prized textiles and sells them for money. He attempts to give the money to the parish priest. But the parish priest is no fool. He knows that Francis's dad, Pietro, is not going to be happy with this and does not want to come into some sort of embroiled state between him and one of the wealthier members of his community. So he tells Francis no. Francis is a little hurt by this. And on his way out of the church, he takes this bag of money and he throws it up on a windowsill and he leaves. Pietro, who had been out on business, comes home, finds out that his textiles, some of his most valuable and prized textiles, have been stolen by his son, appropriated. He holds Francis captive in his home, says, "You're not going out there and doing this stuff. You need to pay for it," locks the kid up in the house. He later, after span of time, leaves, the father does, and then his mom, having a softened heart, lets Francis go. Francis goes right back to the church. Upon Pietro's return, he's livid, and he basically says, "That's it. I'm going to take my son to court. I want the money back for my horse. I want the money back for my textiles." And they both wind up in front of, this is a great name, historically accurate, Bishop Guido. Bishop Guido informs Francis that the property sold belongs to his father. So they are inside this giant church palace church, because it belongs to the bishop. And inside this large hall with his father and his witnesses on one side, Francis standing on the other, along with various priests, petitioners, and onlookers present, Guido informs Francis that the property sold belonged to his father and he needs to return the money. He said that Francis should trust God to provide what the church needed for the repairs. Francis, a person who was raised, reading poetry, singing songs, as you get a group of Italians together, nothing they like to do better than sing. He was in a sense, a little bit of a troubadour in his heart. He was certainly a person that had a flair for the dramatic. So in history, there's a moment where at this time, Francis excuses himself. He goes into a room, and when he comes out, he's completely naked. And he has in his bundle his clothing, his tunic, and the bag of money, which he recovered from the church, and he lays it at the feet of his father. According to his biographer, Angelo, he stated that he was happy to return the money to his father and that he only wants to serve God from now on. Bishop Guido comes down off of his dais, wraps the cloak around Francis, and Francis makes this statement that he called Pietro father, for from this point on, he will only acknowledge his father in heaven. He then moves from mending churches to preaching and caring for the sick. He gathers a following. First, it's just two guys. It's a movement. It's Francis and two guys. And they're doing the stuff. They're doing all the things that made him what he is. He's repairing the church. He's caring for the sick. He's preaching. Then it goes to 12. Profound number in Christianity. So now he's got a dozen disciples. And Francis and the 12 go to Rome to seek acceptance from the Pope and authorization to grow. When I was a kid, I saw a movie. I was about 10 years old in my school, old 35mm, and we watched it on a weekend because that's what we did on the weekends. We watched movies. It was called Brother, Son, Sister, Moon. And I don't know if it was really actually a very good movie because I remember watching it, and that's the last time I watched it. I was 10 years old, so it's been 50 years plus that I saw this movie. And in Wikipedia, the reviews weren't very good. But I remember the scene that I just talked about where Francis comes out naked because I was a kid, and I'm like, and I remember the Pope in this scene, this following scene, kissing Francis's feet. And I don't know if that ever happened, but it stuck in my head that I thought, wow, somebody that looked like Francis, because he was in rags, and somebody that looked like the Pope kissing his feet, there was a tension there. That shouldn't have happened. So the Pope gives Francis authorization to continue his ministry and proceed. It should be noted that St. Francis, unlike so many pillars of the Christian faith, is never depicted, that I can find, with a book or a writing device. I know last week, Ignatius, I think he's mostly depicted with two books and lots of writing devices, because he was a brilliant writer, orator, preacher, intellectual, theologian. Francis is not characterized by his sharp academic mind. Not to say that he wasn't smart. However, he distinguished himself as a doer, as opposed to being a thinker. He was a person that lived out his faith in front of others. He created the friar as a balance to the monk. Monks lived their lives in solitude, writing, sequestered, separate from the community, where the friars, they were anything but. Their job was to go out into the community. They were sent out single, and they would just like sit next to people and wait for them to talk to them. They kept themselves alive by begging, by asking for help, and then in turn helping others. They were in the community. His number of followers increased. The ministry grows. Francis sends friars all over the world. While the Fifth Crusade's ongoing, Francis travels to meet with the Sultan in the Nile in hopes of bringing peace. This friar from Assisi, in his mind, is like, I'm going, and I'm going to talk to the Sultan and try to straighten out this whole crusade thing. So one of the most fascinating stories of Francis, it's just a little side note, but it speaks to his ministry, to be sure, was Claire. Anybody heard of Claire? So Sister Claire, fascinating, and we could do the whole teaching series just on her. But I'll give you a quick synopsis. When she was a woman of 16 or so, she heard Francis preach in the cathedral. Through his spoken word, she fell in love with God and arguably with Francis. She arranged a chaperone meeting with Francis and another friar in her desire to understand how they lived out this calling that he spoke of. She wanted to have a life beyond that of a wife and a mother. She wished to serve her community. Through her meetings with the brothers, she concluded that nothing but serving Christ would satisfy her. So she makes plans to enter ministry. Her plans were put under intense pressure when it's believed that her father died, and she came into money, a dowry for marriage. Her uncle, Manaldo, who was now the head of the family, insisted that she find a suitable husband. She soon gave away, this kind of shows her iron will, she gave away all of her dowry money to the poor. She's planting her flag here. Then on Palm Sunday morning, which is depicted here, right, she put on her prettiest dress and attended church. Bishop Guido handed the traditional olive branch. This piece of art depicts the moment and also shows her last day at home. That night, she would silently leave her family, meet with friends in the street, and they would continue on and meet Francis and other friars. She exchanged her beautiful dress for a habit. She took confession, made vows, and Francis cut her hair in a tonsure. She made a vow to Francis. She made this not to become a cloistered nun, but to serve anyone in need. Her younger sister, Catherine, weeks later would join her. Her uncle, so more than once, led basically raiding parties to try to take these women back, and they never worked out. And it's like something out of a movie. Violence, swords, all of this stuff. They're trying to get these women to come back, and they refused. Francis called her his little plant, for with her arrival came growth. It was in one of the books they said, the brothers were all there, and suddenly this woman shows up, and they're like, now what do we do? Now we got a woman. So they created another order. She would become the first of what would later be called the Order of St. Clair, the Poor Clares, or OSC, a cloistered order of nuns dedicated to prayer and a simple lifestyle of service. In the spring of 2025, Francis is sick. He's staying just outside of San Demonio in Assisi, where St. Clair and her Franciscan sisters resided. Francis is dying. St. Clair is caring for him. And during this time, he wrote a most unique hymn, or a chant, or you can call it a song. The slide here is Francis preaching to the birds. Here is a piece of art that depicts Francis, right, for what many are what he's famous for. Francis, through his actions, spoken words, writings, shows us that as Christians, we are the stewards of this world, this world that we live in, and that our world is part of our spirituality. I'd like to now invite the worship team up, for I'm trying to keep Rule 9 ever in the fore of my mind. We'll finish today with a writing by Francis that sums up much. It's called The Canticle of the Sun. Canticle is known also as a song or a hymn. also known as the Canticle of the Creatures and the Praise of the Creatures. Francis composed this as a joyful celebration of creation. There was nothing in written history up to this point that is anything like this song. He pays attention to the sun, the moon, the wind, the water, the rocks, and all living creatures. He points to the glory of God. He tells of the glory of creation. He encourages the living of life, and he speaks of death. So just take a minute. Just listen to my voice, but really take in the words. It starts, "Most High, all-powerful, good Lord, yours are the praises, the glory, the honor, and all blessing. To you alone, Most High, do they belong, and no man is worthy to mention your name. Be praised, my Lord, through all your creatures, especially Sir Brother Sun, who brings the day, and you give light through him. And he is beautiful and radiant in all his splendor. Of you, Most High, he bears the likeness. Praised be you, my Lord, through Sister Moon and the stars. In heaven you formed them clear and precious and beautiful. Praised be you, my Lord, through Brother Wind and through the air, cloudy and serene, and every kind of weather through which you give sustenance to your creatures. Praised be you, my Lord, through Sister Water, which is very useful and humble and precious and chaste. Praised be you, my Lord, through Brother Fire, through whom you light the night, and he is beautiful and playful and robust and strong. Praised be you, my Lord, through Sister Mother Earth, who sustains us and governs us and who produces varied fruits and colored flowers and herbs. Praise be you, my Lord, through those who give pardon for your love and bear infirmity and tribulation. Blessed are those who endure in peace, for by you, Most High, they shall be crowned. Praised be you, my Lord, through our sister bodily death, from whom no living man can escape. Woe to those who die in mortal sin. Blessed are those who will find your most holy will, for the second death shall do them no harm. Praise and bless my Lord, and give thanks. Give him thanks, and serve him with great humility." On October 3rd, 1226, Francis dies. On July the 16th of 28, he's canonized by Pope Gregory the 14th. Matthew, in his Gospel, chapter 19, verse 21, writes, "If you want to give it all you've got," Jesus replied, "go sell your possessions, give everything to the poor. All your wealth will then be in heaven. Then come and follow me." Francis did exactly that.